Thank you very much. It's really an honor to be part of this symposium and have a chance to honor Dick and his mentorship over the years. And I think we all have examples of teachers or mentors who have influenced us throughout our career and had significant impacts on the directions that we've gone. And certainly Dick has been one of those mentors. I have to tell you, when I first accepted the position and decided to go to NC State, I was a bit nervous because I had talked with Don and Chris and some other people, and I'd heard some stories. I'd heard all about the no-nonsense policy. And even Don had told me that he had driven down with this car full of his possessions, and Dick had him out in the field the first day doing field work before he even got a chance to unpack. And so I was pretty nervous about it. And so I went down to look for an apartment in June of 1990, and I met Dick, and Mrs. Axtell actually joined us and drove us around and really helped us find an apartment. And I thought, geez, I don't know what these guys are talking about. This guy's pretty nice. And I think he softened up over the years. And so I didn't experience the full no-nonsense policy. Although I have to say, before I left to go home, he knew I was an equestrian. And he turned to me and he said, "Do not bring your horse down with you. You're not going to have time for that sort of thing." And in reality, he was right. I was pretty busy. It was a great time in the lab. Actually, we had four postdocs in the lab when I was there, and I really learned a lot from them as well. And so Polly Rueda, who's here in the audience, and Mike Fletcher was there, and Kirti Patel was also there, and who else was there at that time? We had one other postdoc in the lab. So it was a great learning experience. So I was thinking about what common threads. My research career has really diverged quite a bit from the work I did as a master's student at Dick's lab. But there are some common threads. Today, I work a lot on mosquitoes. I do a variety of work on the biology and behavior of mosquitoes. And so what I thought I would tell you about is a little bit more about what I did for my master's. And then I picked one common thread, which others have mentioned today, and that's the modeling, the simulation modeling, which was really really top-notch work that Dick and his students and postdocs did. And I found myself a few years ago going back to some of those papers and rereading them, and we actually used them to develop some models for mosquito vectors in the Northeast. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that today. So I started my master's project, and I really didn't know what I was getting myself into. I didn't realize I'd be spending the next few years in poultry barns and poultry manure. I didn't eat eggs for a couple of years because it had a pretty major impact on me. But my thesis was on different aspects of the biology and behavior of a new pest. It wasn't really a new pest, but nobody had really worked on it. Drosophila, or fruit flies, that were a problem in poultry houses. And so I, like many others who have spoken earlier today, I had a challenge. And my challenge was to determine what species were involved, to try to figure out the best way to sample these pests, and to start looking at some biological control methods using pteromallid parasites. And so this was my first introduction to some really practical, no-nonsense approaches to designing sampling methods. We used a variety of different approaches, the standard ribbon, sticky ribbon, but we also modified leaf blowers, and we used those as aspirators. We also had a gutter, took PVC pipe and made a walking ribbon that we would carry down the center aisle of the poultry house. And then we made some baited traps, which actually worked quite well for collecting Drosophila. And this is Mike Burke, who was a technician. I was really fortunate to have a technician who worked with me, and we drove all over the state of North Carolina. And he actually found me recently, found my address and contacted me, and so we've been reminiscing about those days, and he said to say hello, Dick. So one of the things we did was compare these different methods that we had developed and for evaluating, just monitoring population abundance over time. And some of the methods, like the sweepstick, worked quite well, but it was fairly labor intensive, really wasn't that practical. It cost more to buy the sweepsticks and modify them. And so in the end, we decided that the just a simple visual count on the inside rows of the house, and also using the gutter, the ribbon dipped in the rear gutters of the house, gave us really good, reliable counts of Drosophila abundance over time. So we looked at the seasonal dynamics. We determined that abundance was greatest during the spring and in the fall. And we also looked at what species were involved and determined that Drosophila repleta was the real species that was a pest problem. We did collect a couple of other Drosophila species, but just a very few number of samples. When I went back and looked in the literature, I found that Drosophila repleta is really a cosmopolitan pest in a lot of poultry production facilities in Europe, and also a hospital pest. There were some really entertaining old papers about Drosophila in hospitals. So I also looked at the use of pteromelid wasps. I looked at Mosquitophiorix raptor as a pupal parasitoid for Drosophila. I found it didn't like Drosophila pupae, preferred housefly pupae, probably because the Drosophila repleta puparium was about a third the size of a housefly puparium. And indeed, those parasites that developed in the Drosophila were significantly smaller and likely had reduced fitness. So there's probably some selective pressure not to parasitize Drosophila pupae, because there was likely a fitness disadvantage for these parasites. So one other thing that I did in the laboratory is I worked on temperature-dependent development, and these data eventually went into some of the models, and this was a great experience for me working with staging the different, the development of the fly through time, and I've actually come back to this more recently when we've developed some climate-based models for mosquito vectors, where we've had to go back with local strains that are relevant to our area and build on our knowledge of their temperature-dependent development. So what we've done, and this is in collaboration with a climatologist at Cornell, R. De Gaetano, and a postdoc in my lab, Hongfei Gong, we developed a climate model. This is a discrete time model, which simulated the temporal dynamics of mosquitoes. And the goal was really to, many models are very general and they are designed for broad areas, and I really wanted to focus on very localized microhabitats and then build that up. And so we used West Nile vectors, and we considered West Nile in the model, but we really wanted to create something that could be used for all sorts of different mosquito-borne viruses, even ones that could potentially be introduced. And so here's a schematic of the layout of the model that we developed. And we actually based it on not just laboratory-dependent development, but also development in the field. So in the laboratory, much the same way I did with my Drosophila when I was in Dick's lab, we evaluated temperature-dependent development for a variety of different mosquitoes that are likely candidates as West Nile vectors in the Northeast, including Aedes albopictus, which really hasn't started to overwinter in New York State, but could potentially expand its range into the state. So we used a New Jersey strain of albopictus. But we also looked at alternating temperatures, and in the process, we discovered that when you hold mosquitoes at alternating regimes, their development rates are different. And so I think this is something that we really need to start considering for any type of model in the future, is trying to use more realistic regimes. So we looked at the development time for each life stage from hatch to adult, and the survival rate. We converted everything to degree days and then built our model on this. We also, I have a picture here of individually housed larvae, but that's not a realistic situation. We actually evaluated them in groups under different diet regimes as well. And we also did this in the field, and this was pretty intensive work in the field, and I've been fortunate to have some really talented undergraduate students at Cornell and graduate students who have helped with this. We picked two types of mosquito habitats in the state, a swamp woodland and also a container habitat, a tire habitat. And what we did is we went out twice a week for several years, and we sampled, took a subsample of the population, we ID'd every individual in the sample and staged them and then put them back into the habitat. So we got really nice data on the development through time of the different life stages. We also collected adults in the field using a variety of different traps. And again, I was reminded of my days in Dick's lab and making contraptions, which is one of my favorite things to do. It's a lot of fun and gives you a chance to really be creative. In order to build these models, we needed long-term data sets. So we also were able, through the kindness of collaborators in several states, to get long-year data sets. Some are 50, 60 years long that we use to look at the influence of climate on mosquito populations. We also have two species in New York, which are morphologically indistinguishable most of the time. As adults, Culex pipiens and restuans. So each one of these had to be identified using a PCR-based protocol. But the benefit of this is that we actually have models which we can apply distinctly to pipiens and restuans. And this is just an example from one of the sites, two different tires, and the species and stages that we collected through time. And we noticed a lot of variation over time, even between different habitats in close proximity and also over multiple years. So this presents a real challenge for trying to develop accurate models. The other thing that we did is we did a large group sample. Everyone in the lab participates in this, and we go out once a month and sample from a larger number, or take a larger number of samples, and this is just an example of that from this past year, showing the distribution of species. Another question in developing these sorts of models is the effect of rainfall. A lot of people assume that rainfall is purely beneficial to mosquitoes, and certainly one area we really haven't explored, from what I've seen, has really explored, is the effect of humidity on mosquito survival. And I suspect it has a tremendous impact, and it's linked to rainfall. But also, one of the things that we did, Sander Cohenrot, who was a postdoc in my lab, looked at the effect of rainfall on container breeding mosquitoes, and he picked one local species, Culex pipiens, but also Aedes aegypti, which is well adapted. It's a tropical mosquito, and it does well in areas where you have monsoon rains and long periods of heavy rainfall. And indeed, he found distinct differences between the two. And the Culex pipiens mosquitoes, under heavy rain, we simulated rainfall in the laboratory. Under heavy rainfall, the egg grafts would be flushed out readily out of containers, and also the pupae were highly susceptible to it. The tropical mosquito Aedes aegypti had the ability to dive down to the bottom of the container, so behaviorally it could avoid being flushed out of the containers. So based on this work that we did with the development, I returned to one of the papers that came out of Dick's lab, developing estimating mosquito development using the Sharp and de Michelle model. And this, again, applied to our data, so we used this in the current model. We also had the problem of diapause and how to estimate this, and especially with different vectors that have different diapause stages, different overwintering strategies. We decided to focus on just two species, the Culex species that overwinter as adults, and we built in a diapause parameter into the model. We also developed our own two parameters. One was a moisture index, which is based on rainfall and evaporation, solar radiation and evaporation. And we also developed a daily egg-laying parameter. This really isn't practical. Most mosquitoes they lay a clutch of eggs. They don't lay eggs daily. But it was easier in the model to use a daily egg-laying rate. And this graph here just shows the close correlation between the moisture index and the daily egg-laying rate. So again, the model structure included survival rate, development, and egg-laying rate, and so on. And these are just some of the parameters that we built in. Again, really looking back at some of the models that came out of Dick's lab as well. We then calibrated the model by exploring the parameter space. And what we did is we maximized the correlation between the adult populations from the model output and the true adult captures. Remember, we had those multi-decade data sets that we were able to use. And we did this with 7 years of data from two sites originally, and I'm showing the graph here for two sites. Red is the simulation, and blue is the actual capture. So we had pretty good correlation. Where we deviated from the actual capture was usually magnitude. So we're much better at predicting population increases and the general dynamics, but not so good at predicting the overall numbers. Then to validate the model, we looked at model reliability by selecting segments of 7 years of data, picking 6 years, and then doing a parameter search and predicting the seventh year. And then we just looked at the R values shown here over time. So we had pretty good reliability. This figure just shows some of the different parameters over time. This is a 7 year period. You can see the predicted capture here and the actual capture. Again, we're not quite hitting the mark as far as the number of mosquitoes in the population, but we're doing pretty well as far as predicting peaks. And another thing that we wanted to do is we wanted to be able to forecast mosquito populations. And so we wanted to be able ultimately to develop models that in the tradition of Dick Axtell are very practical and can be used by end users, people involved in mosquito control. And so these graphs show our results from predicting mosquito population in A. The dotted line is what we predicted would happen with the adult population, and here's what actually happened. And at another site, again, predicted an actual capture. So we're pretty pleased with what we've been able to do so far, and we're hoping to expand on this in the future. So I just want to finish up and conclude. So what I've been describing is a model that we think is pretty unique to describe Culex mosquito population dynamics in the Northeast. It takes into consideration microhabitat conditions. The data you get from a weather station, for example, is really not indicative of what mosquitoes are experiencing in their natural habitat. And so we've been able to create correction factors to back extrapolate the microhabitats. We've been fairly good at forecasting mosquito population dynamics. And we're ultimately hoping that we can also incorporate what we know about arbovirus replication rates in mosquitoes. And dynamics of the virus to ultimately look at risk and develop some human risk models. So the dynamics were strongly driven by temperature, rainfall, evaporation rate, and photoperiod. Likely the best models will be ones that are optimized for each small geographic location for accuracy. And we're hoping ultimately to continue improving on these models. So I just wanted to acknowledge Hongfei Gong, who was a postdoc in my lab. He's now working for Oxitec in the UK. My collaborator Art DeGaetano and members of my lab, Greg Glass at Johns Hopkins, and many people in the mosquito abatement districts who provided data sets and also funding sources. So I feel like I've come a long way from my days in Dick's lab in some ways, but in other ways I haven't. And his mentorship has had a significant influence on me and my career, a lot of lessons about writing, about designing experiments and data analysis. And so it's a real pleasure to have the opportunity to honor you, Dick, and I really want to thank you for your mentorship.
Okay, we've asked Wes Watson to provide the concluding remarks for our symposium this afternoon, and all of you know that Wes is the current medical and veterinary entomologist in the Department of Entomology at North Carolina State. Wes, cheers.
Thanks, Don. Dick retired in 96, and I came to NC State in 1997, and one of the things, the first things that I had to do was to take care of 34 years of stuff that Dick had accumulated, and it was in Gardner Hall, and over that 34-year period, he had managed to accumulate about 25% of an entire wing of the building, and it was packed to the gills with things. And so I started out taking things from there and thinking what I could use and what I couldn't use, and moving them to Grinnell's. And as you can imagine, as a young assistant professor just getting started there, my space was significantly smaller than what Dick had. So I had to sort of pick and choose what I could do. And in the process of doing that, I found, as Laura mentioned, lots of contraptions that I had no idea what these things were for. And on occasion, he'd come in and I'd show them to him and say, "What did you use this for?" And he would explain to me how it worked. And over time, I began to see lots of different contraptions pop up. The little aspirators, Laura, that you just had in there. On occasion, you'll find one of those out at the farm. The California houses that Tim worked in, they're still there. We can no longer put birds in them, but we still use them and on occasion for any projects that don't require birds being in them. This last year, I was doing some field work and over near Silk Hope in North Carolina, and I went to Neil Lindley's farm. And I found out that on Neil Lindley's farm, that was the same farm that Tim worked on in 1985. And so we again are using some of the same farms. Tim was in the poultry part of that farm, and I was on the dairy part of that farm. And the owner of the farm remembered all of the interactions with Tim and Dick at that time. It's been very interesting for me to be here. As I was cleaning out some of the paperwork and things like that Dick had accumulated over time, I had a fairly short period of time I was supposed to do this in, but I would open a file drawer and I'd find this body of literature that I had not seen before. And I would find myself leafing through the titles, and I would find a paper and I've never read this before. And I would sit down and I would blow an hour just reading through things. I'm sitting there in dust and debris and everything else, and I would find myself reading lots of Dick's publications. And so I decided it would be very important to collect these and get as many of these together as I could. And I stored them out at Unit 2. They're kind of in a protected area where they don't get wet or anything like that. And this last year, Jeff Baum, who's a postdoc working in the lab, started scanning many of the documents in. And we have acquired 197 of Dick's papers that we know of. And And we've scanned most of them in. There's some of them that are missing, but we've got most of them scanned in as PDFs. We have a bibliography together, and we're in the process of trying to set it up so that we can post that on our NC State website. And with contact, if someone wishes to contact me, we should be able to send you a PDF file relative to any of the publications that you're looking for, if we've got them. Some of the bigger ones, like the Sea Grant publications, we don't have anymore, so we have to find those. The Fly Mod and Mac Mod, as Chris mentioned, I think we'll be able to get those scanned in. One of them that Tim mentioned was the 1986 Fly Control and Confined Livestock publication. That was a color publication with Seba Geigy, and we've scanned that in. It's in full color and as a PDF, so if you contact me, we can send that to you, and you can run it off color printed if you'd like, and have that document yourself. So, you know, I find all the time all the legacy of all of you, everybody here that's been involved with Dick's Lab. I find remnants of your research and efforts at NC State, and it's been a it's just kind of humbling to realize all of the years of research that's been gone on there, and how Dick has really contributed a lot to all of our lives. Thank you, Dick. Well, I guess we can adjourn the symposium. Oh yes, please, Dick.
I don't know. Can people hear me from here? Okay.
I guess here. We can get this off, Dick. Come on over here.
I think we can get this off.
No, I think we can get it.
I think we can get it off. Maybe not.
You got it.
There you go.
Okay.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. Well, I just want to express my real appreciation for the group here, Don, and all the rest who put together this symposium. And I just want to say a few things. It'll be short. One was, I was asked about this. I was sort of embarrassed as well as flattered. And I sort of agreed, yeah, that would be nice, I would appreciate it, but I was also kind of humbled by it. Now, as I heard the presentations here, I think you should keep in mind that this is a sample of the students, graduate students and postdocs, and all their talks were stimulating, and their work is excellent. But the other people who were not on the program but are on the list of being graduate students and postdocs equally have had outstanding careers. Now, the point I want to make is that all of these people came in to graduate work with me as very well qualified, motivated, intelligent people. And they could accomplish these things without me. I do feel that I contributed some by pushing them so that maybe they would perform 110% instead of just accepting a lesser percentage of accomplishment that would require less effort. And the result of this was, I remember, but they didn't talk about it, occasions when they really got pissed off at me.
Never.
Because I was demanding the fourth rewrite of a paper or something of that nature. You know, it could be better, but you know, it always was better. So again, I want to thank you all. The presentations were very flattering and probably a bit overstated. And I asked if I could have a time for a refute, but I don't want to refute any of those statements, even if they're overstated. I guess if they'd gone beyond that to say that I could walk on water, I would have had to refute that, or at least point out that I get my feet wet. So thank you very much again. I appreciate this. It makes me feel like maybe my career was worth a heck of a lot more than I realized. Thank you.